From KCBW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The way historian Matthew Basso found a lost collection of Depression-era writings sucked me in like any good detective story. He was searching through some archives in Montana when he came across a folder labeled Men at Work. Inside, he found six short stories, along with documents that indicated there were more. And so began Basso's search for the missing essays. And that's just the backstory. What's inside these stories is especially compelling. In Basso's words, they revealed the pleasures, pains, and social politics of what the working world looked like 70 years ago. Today on the program, we're talking about men at work and what work means then and now. Plus the Greek classic Antigone with a modern twist. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. In the midst of the Great Depression, the federal government created an innovative and controversial work program for writers, artists, and other creative types. Part of that effort was to write about the actual work experience of Americans, but those accounts missed a publishing deadline and were shelved. Decades later, historian Matthew Basso stumbled upon a manuscript in a Montana archive. And today on the program, he joins us to describe how this eclectic collection of essays titled Men at Work finally made it to print. Matthew Basso is in studio with me. And Matthew Basso, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Basso is an assistant professor of history and gender studies and the former director of the American West Center at the University of Utah. He is co-editor of Across the Great Divide, Cultures or Manhood in the American West. And his latest project, as I mentioned, is titled Men at Work, Rediscovering Depression-Era Stories from the Federal Writers Project, published by the University of Utah Press just this last weekend. And we're grateful that you're here. Thanks so much for your time.
Of course.
Also with us, Emily Tips. She is program manager and binding instructor at the Book Arts Program at the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah, also with Red Butte Press. Red Butte Press is behind the limited edition Women at Work, a companion volume to the Men at Work essays. And Emily Tips joins me in studio as well. Emily, good morning to you.
Thanks for having me.
Judy Blunt, Matthew Ivan Bennett, and others will be reading as part of the At Work lecture series tomorrow, Thursday, September 6th at 7 o'clock in the Marriott Library's Gould Auditorium. The event is free and open to the public, and we'll give you more details on that as we go. Later on in the program, the enduring appeal of classical Greek theater. But first, At Work. How did your parents or grandparents eke out a living during the Depression era? What do you want to know about the working lives of Americans during the Great Depression? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Before we delve into the volume or even the backstory, Matthew Basso, what did you learn from the content of these essays?
I learned the texture of work. I think all too often we forget when we think about work about the actual activities involved in labor and how influential those are to virtually a third of our day, if not longer. These stories really provide an intimate portrait of how folks in the 1930s felt about labor, how they felt about the things that they touched, the things that they made, the things that they did. Sometimes they felt remarkably powerful. Other times they felt as if the system had taken charge of them. I really felt like I had a whole new window onto the world of work, and it made me reflect about my own working life and other people's working lives in brand new ways.
It's interesting because you are a labor historian. I mean, you would think that you would know everything there is to know about work, and yet reading these stories provided additional insights to you. How people felt, I mean, was that kind of the missing piece to your academic work prior to this?
Well, it arguably is the missing piece, not just to my academic work and other labor historians. Now, there's labor historians and stories out there literature stories that really kind of describe work, but they're few and far between. Often labor historians really focus on the relationship among workers, the relationship of workers to their society, the relationship between labor and management, so on and so forth. But the actual physical act of labor can get lost. And indeed, the original editor of Men at Work, a remarkable intellectual named Harold Rosenberg, said in the late 1930s when he envisioned this volume, what we've done, even though we focused an entire decade on talking about workers, is not focused on work, on the actual labor of Americans.
Give us the context of these stories. The Great Depression, a devastating economic depression. About a quarter of Americans were out of work. The president at the time, FDR, created several federal work programs, and one that is the product of Men at Work is the one that dealt with employing unemployed writers. Describe this group of writers that is called Federal One.
Absolutely. So the Federal Writers Project is really a tiny, tiny part of the Works Progress Administration.
The WPA.
The WPA, exactly. One of the multiple different agencies, so the largest, that put workers, ordinary Americans, back to work. This was relief work so that Americans could put food on the table, have shelter over their heads, clothe themselves and their families. This was essential work, and it really reinvigorated the nation. It also produced, as many folks know, a massive amount of federal works that we still enjoy today. Parks around Utah, national parks, large dam projects, electrification projects. It was a remarkable effort to reconstruct the nation in many ways. But the imagining of Federal One was that, as Harry Hopkins, one of the main heads of the New Deal, said, listen, they need to eat too. And that is the idea that artists are workers as well. So Federal One put musicians to work for the federal government. They put painters and sculptors to work for the federal government. They put, of course, famously, writers to work. It was only a small, small fraction of the program, but it's one of the best known parts of the WPA because what they left us, this legacy, this remarkable portrait of America during the Great Depression, what one scholar has called the very soul of the nation, was revealed by Federal One.
And yet you note that Federal One was a bit controversial. Why?
Well, the Republican Party thought that this was nothing more than a propaganda arm for the New Deal and for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So when they were able to re-seize some power in the late 1930s, they did away with Federal One, at least the national office, by and large. What they did was they decentralized and they put the money that was remaining in the program out to the state offices, where the notion was they needed to finish certain projects, most especially the state guides. And the FWP state guides are really perhaps the most famous product of this remarkable effort.
I do want to get to the writings. They are remarkable, but you have to tell us how these essays landed in your lap. As I mentioned, you were, rooting through some archives, incidentally, in Montana, and you came upon this folder titled Men at Work. I mean, what was it about the folder that made you open it? Why did you open it?
Well, this is sort of what I research. I research men, especially masculinity and labor, and I said to myself, wow, that's a perfectly titled folder. What's it doing in this WPA collection from the 1930s? And as I opened it up, I found six remarkable short stories that were just so textured, these incredible descriptions of an irrigationist doing his labor, of a fire watchtower employee doing her labor, of a rodeo worker, and so on and so forth. And I was just thunderstruck. They were beautiful stories. And they had a cover letter with them that said, I'm sorry, these arrived too late to be included in Men at Work. And the letter was dated 1941 from the National Office of the Federal Writers Project. This made no sense to me as a historian and as a scholar of the Great Depression, because the Federal Writers Project National Office more or less gets shut down in 1938. Well, it turned out that these folks hung on. And by 1941, they were able to convince the higher-ups that they wanted to start a new project that would document America in a different way than the state guides had. They called it The Hands That Built America. And they really wanted to look at the labor that built this country. This was Men at Work, the first volume, it turned out. And they finished it in rough form, but it got boxed up with World War II. Everyone got deployed to different parts of the government, the OWI, and so on and so forth. And really, it was put into an attic, quite literally, in the Library of Congress, and left there until I called an archivist and said, listen, have you ever heard of this? He said, that's intriguing. Let me check. 2 hours later, he called back. They had, in fact, gone through those manuscript sources, and they had one copy of Men at Work.
Single copy. What did that copy look like?
Well, it's old onion skin. It's typed. It can be very difficult to read. For a historian, it looked wonderful.
Matthew Basso, he's an assistant professor of history and gender studies, also the former director of the American West Center at the University of Utah. And he is the editor of a new volume of work hot off the press titled Men at Work, Rediscovering Depression-Era Stories from the Federal Writers Project. If you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about Depression-Era writing, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. You mentioned the editor, Harold Rosenberg. What do we know about him? You called him a brilliant intellectual.
He was indeed. Harold Rosenberg was part of a vast group, really, of intellectuals that came of age during the 1930s. Most of these folks were on the left politically, but they had their own divides between them. And Rosenberg was first and foremost an artist and an art critic. But during the 1930s, he worked for various federal agencies, including the Federal Writers Project. In that role is when he edited Men at Work, but it's in the post-war that he becomes famous as an art critic who creates the term action painting. And in that, he also characterizes a real shift in the post-war away from the Great Depression. And interestingly enough, he also becomes a fairly adamant anti-communist.
And so he compiled all of these essays under this this overriding goal to write about the actual work done by Americans. 70 years later, you've got these writings into print. But Men at Work wasn't enough for you. You wanted to do a companion volume, Women at Work. Tell us how this project also evolved.
Well, Men at Work, one of the things that really emphasizes to the writers that were asked to contribute all across the country was, listen, you either need to have done this work yourself or seen it done. It was really a focus on the labor. And we said to ourselves as we were imagining other ways to think about work, you know, we need to do labor ourselves, not just the intellectual labor of typing on a computer, but wouldn't it be intriguing to make a book? And it so happens that the University of Utah has one of the foremost book arts programs in the country, 4,000 square feet of remarkable historic presses. I approached that program and the wonderful people up there, and we talked about making a book, but a book that had a second purpose as well, not just the construction and feel and what it would mean to make a book using 1930s technology linked with modern technology, but also to rebalance Men at Work. Because one of the problems with the volume, and it's reflective of the Great Depression, the focus is on men at work. We lose the picture of women at work, and women labored, of course, mightily during the Great Depression, both in unpaid and paid labor, and their world was difficult, challenging, and yet many would argue they're the ones that helped see American families through that economic crisis. Mm.
Emily Tipps with the Book Arts Program at the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah is also with us. And Emily, we will get to your volume shortly, but I mean, what did you think of this idea initially of creating a book sort of reflecting that physical process of compiling manuscripts together, binding it, all of that, about work?
Mm-hmm. Well, making books, the physical labor of making books and the materiality of books themselves is what we're in the business of at the Book Arts Program and Red Butte Press. So a book that was sort of consciously involved with investigating that as an idea was very appealing to us, along with you know, working with other departments in the university, working with the America West Center, and sort of sharing our passion for that particular physical manual labor with others in the institution. So it was instantly appealing. And the fact that we could involve students in the labor and collaborate with so many people just made it really appealing for us.
Emily Tips is a program manager and binding instructor at the Book Arts Program at the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah. The Red Butte Press, which is part of that, is behind the limited edition Women at Work. It is a companion volume to Men at Work. And Men at Work is a new volume of essays rediscovering Depression-era stories from the Federal Writers Project, edited and introduced by my other guest, Matthew Basso, from the University of Utah, a labor historian. Several of the essays will be part of a lecture series that kicks off tomorrow, September 6th at 7 o'clock in the Marriott Library's Gould Auditorium. The event is free and open to the public, and you can find out more on our website, kcpw.org. We're talking about some newly published writings from the Depression, and if you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, stories that offer a glimpse into the working lives of ordinary Americans during the Great Depression. They were discovered quite accidentally by my guest Matthew Basso, an historian at the University of Utah, and they reveal quite a lot about the place of labor in the 1940s and the 1930s, also how work shaped personal identities and social politics. And Matthew Basso is with us, assistant professor of history and gender studies at the University of Utah. Also with us, Emily Tips, the program manager of the Book Arts Program at the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah. There is a companion volume to the Men at Work essays titled Women at Work, and a lecture series on both will kick off tomorrow, Thursday, September 6th at 7 o'clock at the Marriott Library on the University of Utah campus. It's free and open to the public. But you can join our conversation as well. Do you have stories from parents or grandparents about making a living through the Great Depression? How do you think work back then is the same, or is it different from our working lives today? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones. Bill has been holding from South Salt Lake. Bill, hi.
Hi to your guests. And I'm reading a book right now about midway through into the Depression area. It's called There is Power in a Union by Philip Gray. And what's kind of impressed me about this is the number of women at work still that, you know, in the Depression era, about working women. And the important impact they had on union organizing. I think I'm 68 years old. I would tend to think of the Depression era union movement as basically almost entirely male, and that it almost reads as if it's almost a 50-50 proposition.
Interesting question, Bill. Thanks so much for the call. Professor Basso, the role of women in the early labor movement.
Well, I'm glad you were struck by women's place in the labor movement in the 1930s. It is an era of growth for women in the labor movement. But as you noted in your original comment, it's not so much that women were 50-50, but scholars have really been struck by their important role and their growing role in the labor movement. But they've also been struck by the resistance to women in the labor movement. While the movement itself grows exponentially during the 1930s, especially due to support for collective bargaining by the Roosevelt administration and because of the new organizing models put in place by the CIO, there are many rank-and-file male workers that are resistant to having women organized in their unions, really for fear of losing status in two different ways. One, the psychic status of being a man and saying this is men's work and we're the ones that are the breadwinners. And two, the material status of not wanting to share jobs or not wanting to have women potentially deflate wages, which was a real concern on the part of the labor movement. Nonetheless, there were some very progressive labor leaders and some remarkable women that took the lead in pushing women more deeply into the labor movement. And of course, we know that grows dramatically more so during World War II.
Mm. One of the essays in your Men at Work book deals with gender issues in the workplace. There's a great essay titled Sade Duggett, that's short for Sadie Duggett, by an author named Ned DeWitt. And I mean, to Bill's question about, you know, the place of women in the workplace has certainly evolved, but back then women were trying to find a place. And I think this essay shows very perfectly, you know, looking for an inroad. Say Duggett finds her niche as a caterer to the oil field miners. Is that right?
That's right. And women were confined largely still to service sector work. So women make major inroads in clerical positions, things that are gone now, a typewriter operator, and the operators of other office machines that are no longer with us, replaced, of course, by the computer. But they also really make some inroads in the service sector that they've, to a certain degree, dominated for a decade or so, at least, by the 1930s. These are sales positions and positions like cooks and waitresses and so on and so forth. And here you've got this one remarkable story about a woman who, while she does this, she cooks, right? She's in a traditional, supposedly traditional feminine sphere. She's a leader. She's a remarkable businesswoman. She's flesh and she's just an amazing character. Anyone who gets the chance to read Ned DeWitt's portrait of Sade Duggett will see an angle on the Great Depression and on women's labor that I think they won't expect at all.
Mm-hmm. And she was certainly an entrepreneur to be reckoned with, and she was willing to move to where the work was, which I found quite interesting. You don't think of women kind of taking on that role of, you know, packing up your bags and going to where the jobs are.
That's right. I mean, that's the classic image of what men did during the Great Depression. Look for work anywhere and everywhere. And when they did that, we know that part of the story is that they left families behind. And who was in charge of making sure that those families continued to thrive if possible, but at least stay alive? It was women, either through some paid labor or a combination of paid labor and relief work, or simply anything that they could do, often as a community, to keep their families together.
Mm. Women at Work. What are the messages in the Women at Work volume? I understand there's a contemporary essay written by Judy Blunt. I mean, how does she define women at work during the Depression?
Well, Judy Blunt's essay is actually a more personal response from her experience as a woman at work in Montana, which is the companion essay from Men at Work that's also featured in Women at Work, is a rodeo rider from Montana or working in Montana. So there's sort of a geographical parallel there. And Judy Blunt's approach is to discuss her notion of work as a woman growing up on a ranch. And so she sort of investigates traditional so-called women's work on the ranch, which includes the production of food and the primarily the production of food in cooperation with everyone on the ranch.
And as I recall, the intersection of men's work and women's work on the ranch deals with food.
Right, exactly. And that one of her central points, I think, is that where food is concerned, ultimately it's everyone doing what has to be done to make sure that everyone gets to eat.
Well, I'm all for that. I can totally get around food. Everyone can get behind food. We're speaking with Emily Tipps, the program manager of the Book Arts Program at the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah. The Book Arts Program is behind Women at Work, a companion volume to Men at Work. And Men at Work is a new volume of essays edited by my other guest, Matthew Basso, an assistant professor of history and gender studies at the University of Utah. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're talking about Depression-era writing and the notion of work, how it's changed, how it stayed the same. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to Heidi in Salt Lake City. Heidi, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm very excited about this new research, and I have a personal take on some of this story. My mother's mother, a very strong woman, had to raise three little girls on her own during the Depression era, my mother being the youngest of the three. And doing that, she worked very hard as an elementary school teacher, at times being the only teacher in a one-room school, including on some Native American reservations here in Utah. And so I'm very interested in seeing more of her story in history, which is important for everyone to be aware of. And I had a question to see if Matthew plans to form a future class and use his newfound research so that we, you know, the general public and students at the University of Utah could learn more about this work.
Okay, good question, Heidi. Thanks so much for the call. Professor Basso, what do you think? Is there a class in this?
Oh, there most certainly is. I teach a fair bit on the Great Depression and the World War II period, and I've used these stories in multiple different ways. And they really are a avenue that students get excited about because they're new stories, are stories that people haven't seen before, and yet they jump off the page. And what's more, students, and really all of us, have work experiences. This is something that we can really connect with, thinking about the way that labor shapes us, our frustrations with it, and yet our fascination with it. I often tell folks, everyone likes to talk about work, even if they hate work. We're fascinated in what each other do. And here you've got 34 stories about the nuts and bolts of a remarkable range of jobs.
I found it interesting. I mean, I never thought that I would self-identify with a miner. And yet there was this terrific story by Claire C. Anderson, who, incidentally, is a Utahn. Maybe you can talk about that, Professor Basso. But Claire's essay titled The Minekeeper really resonated with me because we live in this place where we're expected to do more with less. We talk about multitasking all the time, and to find out that this is really nothing new, I thought was enlightening for me.
It's so true that if you read these stories, you see the remarkable range of skills that workers in the 1930s were expected to have. And I'm talking about work that we think of as manual labor. These were remarkably skilled men and women. After all, they rebuilt the country during the 1930s, and they also had to stretch their skills, learn new things all the time, fill in for other workers, as Claire Anderson's story really puts perfectly.
Would you mind reading a very short passage from Claire's essay? This is The Mine Timekeeper.
I'd be happy to. And here again, we emphasize, as you said, multitasking. Anderson writes of the timekeeper, "If you think I've got a snap around here, remember that at this hole, I'm a timekeeper, bookkeeper, office manager, troubleshooter, first aidman, storekeeper, and bull cook. And just yesterday, the boss asked me if I could learn to assay so I could help the assayer in my spare time."
This sounds so familiar to today's workplace where, you know, people are downsizing and they're asked to do more and more and more.
And indeed, you also see the community of a workplace. There's tensions, of course, but in this story, Claire Anderson's story, the mine timekeeper actually fills in for a miner who wants to go see his wife who's about to have one of their children. And it's this sense of community that we really recall about the Great Depression that comes through in this volume, but so too does the tension around work and the need to work, the need to put food on the table, which, my goodness, we see today, every day.
Mm. Another theme that struck me was how people were uncertain in the face of technology and change. There's a great essay by Grace Winkleman. Is she a Utahna too, or it was set in Utah? I can't remember.
She's a Utah person, okay. Absolutely. She's a remarkable woman.
Tell us about her, just briefly.
Grace Winkleman was, we think, the first woman sports editor in the country. Mm-hmm. She wrote for a Salt Lake paper. She went to the University of Utah after having moved all around the West with her family. Her dad was a mine foreman himself, and she had just a remarkable series of events in her life, including being charged for a bank robbery and a murder.
Wow.
She was cleared, everyone. but the Winkleman went on to become the state director of the Federal Writers Project here in Utah, and then had a really long career doing a whole range of other things. You know, we talk about people today doing five different jobs in a lifetime at least. Well, Grace Winkleman did at least five different jobs in her lifetime.
And she wrote this terrific essay titled Mules Ain't Jackasses, talking about the role that mules played in the mining industry. There's a great passage there. I don't know if you have... You can certainly paraphrase if you like, but I just thought her descriptions were so vivid of, you know, how she felt about... change was a coming.
That's right. So mules used to work, as some folks know, in the mines very regularly, as did horses. And Winkleman, in this remarkable story, writes, "Well, Gramp, those electric locomotives will do away with all of that." Speaking of the mules, of course, there. "Those newfangled contraptions will be the ruination of mining. They just invented them to get a mule skinner's job. Somebody's got to run them all the time, ain't they? Won't go back to them by themselves, will they? Won't stop themselves at the loading chutes, will they? They ain't going to bring any of those damn things in here, is they?" I answered no, covering all questions with one answer. I knew how he felt. Pesky, stubborn, and ornery, a mule may be, but sometimes they seem like one of us. I like to watch them make their unguided way to the loading stations with their string of empties, and if the drift was long, see them stop on their own mule power under the loading chutes.
That's so great. That's a passage from the volume Men at Work, Rediscovering Depression-Era Stories from the Federal Writers Project. The voice is Matthew Basso. He's an assistant professor of history and gender studies at the University of Utah, the editor of this new volume. Also with us, Emily Tipps, program manager at the Book Arts Program at the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah. Our time is short. Individually, these are such unique character sketches. I mean, if you look at them collectively, what do you take from all of these stories as a whole? Professor Basso.
I take the human face of the Great Depression. I take the sense that while we think about the Great Depression as a period of unemployment, there was an enormous number, a remarkable number of Americans hard at work, and that they thought about their labor in the way that we think about their labor. That is to say that labor is an essential part of who we are. The actual work that we do is central to making us, to making our emotions each day, to making us skilled people, to making us productive people, and sometimes to making us frustrated people. It's just so important to our lives to remember the place of work, and also to remember that the person that's sitting across from you is also a worker, right? Think about their job. Think about what they do. Think about what they go through in their lives. Talk to them about that labor and listen to people talk about work, because there's really poetry in it.
Mm. Emily Tipps, I mean, what do you think these writings offer the contemporary reader?
Well, I think they offer us the chance to examine our own labor and remember the legacy of laborers that have come before us and what they and their work still has to offer us in this new context of the digital and constantly emerging and evolving technology. What remains both in the abstract sense but also physically, you know, and how we can use our bodies and our minds in what we do, and as a sort of moment in history.
And Matthew Bastow, I mean, do you think that work is substantially more similar than different than it was 70 years ago? I mean, are our working lives very much the same from a couple of generations ago?
I think that things have changed, but there's an awful lot of similarities. Now, a lot of Americans aren't, of course, in manufacturing jobs. They're not working in plants and so on and so forth. But the emotions that go along with work are still there. And we need to remember there sure are still a whole lot of Americans that are doing this sort of labor. One of the opening stories to this volume is about a shepherd. We still have shepherds, right? We forget that, but we still have men and women doing this ancient form of work. And it reminds us that part of our own world is long and deep and historical, and that's labor.
Speaking with Matthew Bastow, he's an assistant professor of history and gender studies at the University of Utah. His new volume of work is titled Men at Work, Rediscovering Depression-Era Stories from the Federal Writers Project. And Professor Bastow, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Emily Tipps, program manager and binding instructor at the Book Arts Program at the J. Willard Marriott Library at the University of Utah. That's a mouthful. They are behind Women at Work, a companion volume to the Men at Work series. And Emily, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And a lecture series, At Work Lectures, will kick off tomorrow, Thursday, September 6th, at 7 o'clock at the Marriott Library's Gould Auditorium at the University of Utah. The event is free and open to the public. And if you need more detail, go to our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, a modern take on Greek drama. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. The annual Greek Festival is coming to downtown this week. And with those homemade gyros and domates, how about pairing those with some ancient Greek drama? The Classical Greek Theater Festival is also rolling into town. And today on the program, we're talking about the timeliness and the timelessness of this year's production, Antigone. Joining me in studio is Larry West. He's a teacher, playwright, and director of over 200 university and professional productions here in Utah, as well as Idaho, Minnesota, Texas, other locations. He's the director of Antigone in this year's Classical Greek Theater Festival, and it is his sixth time with the Classical Greek Theater Festival tour. Larry West, welcome. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Anne Louise Brings. She is a senior and an honors student working toward a BFA in theater performance at Westminster College, and she plays the title role of Antigone in this year's Classical Greek Theater Festival. Anne Brings, thanks so much for your time as well.
Thank you.
Westminster College presents Antigone this Friday, September 7th at 5 o'clock in the Richer Commons on the Westminster campus. The Classical Greek Theater Festival tour will continue throughout the month with performances at Red Butte Garden Amphitheater, BYU, and Weber State, just to name a few. You can find a full listing of performances on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about Greek theater, about Greek drama, or Antigone specifically, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Larry West, the dramatist Sophocles penned Antigone in 441 BC. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
Why do you think this play in particular and Greek drama generally endures, you know, a couple thousand years later?
I guess the tradition with Greek theater, they always present ideas that are arguable, and you have characters present two sides of an argument, and it seems like those arguments never quite go away. Antigone is about tradition versus a religious, a personal desire to do right, and it fights against tradition and the establishment. Man, that just doesn't go away. So
we're still doing that today.
Yeah, we
huh?
seem to be still doing it. And my initial image for the show was the Time Magazine Person of the Year last year, which was The Protester. That's Antigone. You look at that picture, and that's her. So it's still with us. And I don't know that this play is going to change it one way or the other, but at least make us aware that it's with us.
You decided to shed the Greek togas and use costuming that is much more familiar to the contemporary audience. Why did you choose the Arab Spring as the backdrop for your production of Antigone?
I guess my feeling is that people don't change. Technology changes, and I'm interested in the immediacy of technology. There was something really kind of frightening and interesting when we all found out that Osama bin Laden had been killed, and within hours, there were celebrations all over the country. And those celebrations were being communicated back and forth on Facebook and Twitter. So that social media is a real driving force in this production. People have their cell phones, and people are communicating, and people are texting and getting this information about the protest back and forth.
Let's briefly remind our listeners who Antigone is and just what the play is about. She's the daughter of Oedipus, who, of course, was fated to kill his father and marry his mother. So she's the result of this incestuous union. But she's got her own problem. She wants to bury her brother, which has been decreed illegal by the reigning, is it Creon? Antigone, tell us more about your character and how you kind of delved into this, Anne Brings.
Well, I think that I loved, first of all, Larry's concept of the protester. And that was something that we were told as soon as we got into auditions, that that was the concept for this character. She was a protester. So for me, Antigone is not only basically the result of this cursed marriage. She's from a cursed family. She's the little sister looking for a cause. And so, yes, she wants to honor her brother, but also this becomes a greater cause. To defy Creon, to uphold the law of the gods, is the most important thing to her. And that is a very powerful statement to make in today's society. And with this technology that is filling us to the brim with images and texts and Facebook statuses, she's kind of going back to the roots and saying, wait, 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 what about the gods? And so that's something that I've really tried to explore and I love about her.
Can you give us a taste of you in the role of Antigone? Is there a particular passage that you find very powerful or empowering or evokes something from the audience? Maybe Larry West. Can you think of something for her to play?
Trying to think.
There's that kind of the last scene when you are kind of alone and talking to yourself, and maybe there's some
absolutely
stuff in there.
So in the very last scene, she actually is lucky enough, the character Antigone is lucky enough to have basically her own last ode, her last aria. And so there's a huge monologue at the end where she kind of questions exactly what's going on and finds that she is right. And I guess I can jump into that a little bit. I feed upon the hope that I shall be welcomed by you, my dear mother, and by my sweet father, and by you, my dear brothers. With my own hands, I washed you all and prepared your bodies for burial. Then I poured drink offerings onto your tomb. For tending to your body, Polynices, see what I suffer. Wise people will say I did well to honor you.
Beautiful. Anne Louise Brings. She's a senior and honor student working toward a BFA in theater performance at Westminster College. She plays the title role of Antigone in this year's Classical Greek Theater Festival, which kicks off Friday, September 7th at 5 o'clock on the Westminster College campus. Also with us, Larry West, a teacher, playwright, and director of this production, who's been with the Classical Greek Theater Festival for 6 years. Larry West, if you've never been to see Classical Greek Theater, what advice do you have for the first timer?
I really believe that first timer just needs to show up with an open mind and an open heart and be prepared to go on this journey. I feel really strongly that this play doesn't need a lot of research and background, and you don't need to know Greek, and you don't need to know even much of the story because it's contained, or the backstory, because it's contained within the play. I don't feel that I am a Greek scholar or even particularly a director of Greek theater. I'm a director of good theater, and these stories and these plays, the six of them that I have done, have just appealed to me on that level. So
there are certain elements of Greek theater, though, that are very unique. The chorus.
Absolutely.
When you perform at dawn?
Well.
Or it has been traditionally?
Has been.
Okay.
We perform at 9 o'clock at Red Butte, which is still kind of early for some of our patrons, but we encourage them to bring coffee and donuts and muffins and whatever to keep them awake or even stay up all night. And
but explain the role of the chorus in Greek theater. That is something that's
Yeah, it is unique. And the chorus comments upon action that's ready to happen, sometimes comments on action that has happened. Sometimes it gives information to characters. I have taken the chorus and really changed the way that chorus works, because rarely do they function as a full chorus. They function as individuals in this world. There's one of the choral odes that I have called Facebook, Twitter, and basically they are all on their smartphones getting this information out to the world and to each other. So I've taken that chorus idea of commenting on the action and then kind of exploded it into, again, the social media network that we have.
And you're nodding vigorously. I'm
yes.
assuming that you love this element of this production of Antigone.
I absolutely do. I think that one of the reasons that people shy away from Greek theater is the choral element. Sometimes it's because the chorus is not well done, they're hard to understand in unison, but sometimes it's because it's a foreign element to our theaters. We don't usually incorporate it into contemporary plays. And I think that Larry and our wonderful choreographer, Darlene, have done, they both done a great job in updating the chorus so that it is more of a social media network, which is something that's much more familiar to our audience. Mm-hmm. And I love that.
The Classical Greek Theater Festival is moving to Westminster College?
This is our second year at Westminster. They hosted last year and hosted again this year.
Are there any other changes on the festival tour that you'd like to mention?
We're going to Denver this year. We haven't been to Denver before. We're also performing just outside Zion National Park. I think they have been in that venue before. Back at BYU, I have the distinction of having been banned at BYU a few years ago from my production of Bacchae, and I will assure BYU and anybody else that there's nothing in this production that we'll be banned for, I hope.
Well, it sounds like you've got a full schedule over the next month or so. Anne Brings, what are you hoping the audiences will take from your performance?
Oh, my performance in particular. I think that the audiences will understand that this is a timeless story. And I don't think that applies just to me. I think that's something that can be taken from the entire production. At the very root of Antigone, I think this is a good old-fashioned family drama, and there's a lot of it. And people can really relate to that. There's a lot of tension. And then with the idea of the social media and networking capabilities, there's a lot of idea of being so connected that we're disconnected to each other. We're so connected to these devices. We're connected to the internet. We're connected to Facebook, to Twitter, to Pinterest. But have we really stopped to see the other person that's standing next to us on that smartphone? Mm. And I think that that's something that will really connect with the audience. And there's a lot of commentary in there.
Larry West, your final words. How is this going to resonate with us?
I think it will resonate on a very personal human level. And part of that is because of our particular Antigone. Annie's approach to her is very human. She's not an icon. She's not a goddess. She is a human being trying to sort through an extremely difficult situation and coming through that with nobility and grace. And yes, at times, there's some times we are really not liking her, and she rises above that and becomes this incredible human being that tells the story.
Sounds like Greek theater is here to stay.
I hope so.
Larry West, teacher, playwright, director of this year's production of Antigone. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
And Louise Brings, senior at Westminster College, playing Antigone in this year's Classical Greek Theater Festival. And thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
Westminster College presents Antigone this Friday, September 7th at 5 o'clock in the Richer Commons on the Westminster College campus. And then the Classical Greek Theater Festival tour will continue throughout the month with performances at Red Butte Garden Amphitheater, BYU, Weber State, many other places. There's a full listing on our website, kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Coming up tomorrow, Wolves with Carter Niemeyer. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.